You're listening to Agile Ideas, the podcast, hosted by Fatima Ibuchi.
For anyone listening out there not having a good day, please know there is help out there.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Agile Ideas, the podcast. I'm Fatima, CEO at Agile Management Office, and your host for today. On today's episode, we have a very special guest, one that I've been really looking forward to ever since he said yes. We have Dr. Elisha Goldstein. Dr. Elisha Goldstein is one of the world's most preeminent mindfulness teachers, a clinical psychologist, author of numerous books, creator of the world's first mental health accelerator program called Uncover the Power Within, and the course in Mindful Living Professional Teacher Training Program. Dr. Goldstein is co-founder of the Center for Mindful Living and Psychotherapy in Los Angeles and founder of the Mindful Living Collective, the online collaborative nexus of mindfulness and well-being. For the last 20 years, as a psychologist and mindfulness educator, he has been at the forefront of integrating curriculum and training for therapists, educators, business professionals, active military, parents, and others in the art and science of mindful living. His books include Uncovering Happiness, The Now Effect, a mindfulness-based stress reduction workbook, and MBSR Every Day. In an increasingly fragmented society, he's working to bring people together so that they may motivate and inspire one another in far-reaching ways. Now, I have to admit, I am inspired by Dr. Elisha Goldstein, so having the opportunity to have him on the show today is being absolutely exciting. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Elisha Goldstein. Thank you, Elisha, for joining us today.
Yeah, it's so great to be here.
And you are in LA, is that correct?
That's correct.
Amazing. Well, thank you for joining us on this afternoon. I'm so excited, as I previously mentioned, to have you on the show to dig into a lot more about what you've been doing. I'm keen to sort of just understand sort of how you entered the world of psychology. When did that happen? How did that come about? How did you fall into it?
Well, you know, it's maybe like a hidden secret for a lot of therapists and psychologists is that they oftentimes come to the field because they want to heal themselves in some way. And then they also want to help other people, sometimes vice versa. And for me, I was, you know, there was a time when I was in the corporate world and I was actually, you know, managing sales teams and I was quite successful at it. And at the same time, I was in a cycle of working hard, but playing a whole lot harder. And I was, you'd find me at clubs like late at night and I was just abusing my mind and body with drugs and alcohol. But no one could really tell on the outside because I was just really successful at what I was doing. And so it was a little confusing, but I knew there was a hole somewhere and I started going to therapy and I started going to some different therapists. And I also started reading different types of like Eastern philosophy books and around mindfulness and this type of work. And it was a dark night of the soul one night where I was south of Market Street in San Francisco. And I ended up with this guy that I said to my friends, if you ever catch me with this guy was like, you know, to me, the bottom of the barrel. And as far as like, he was just very lost in his own abuse and addiction. And so there I was with him. And at some point I just kind of woke up and I said, I don't want to live this life anymore. I'm lucky to be alive. I walked home and I went away to a retreat for a month. And it was there that I got in touch with someone there who introduced this concept of mindfulness to me, of just awareness, of learning how to train my mind to be more present to what's here with it, just an orange. Mm-hmm. And he had me pay attention to this orange in a particular way, coming to my senses. And he said, how do you feel? And I said, I feel pretty relaxed. And he said, what would the days, weeks, and months ahead be like if you had more of this? And I said, sign me up. And a month went by and I came back and went back to my job. And for 2 weeks, I was fine. I was like amazing. And then after 2 weeks, I just fell back into my old habits. So I realized there was more work to be done. Mm-hmm. And so I started again, going back to therapy and working in this field of mindfulness a little bit. And then I went back to graduate school. And that's when I went deeper into all these different areas. Mm-hmm. And so I really kind of delved deep into the field of training my mind, the importance of that, and working with people and with myself, and learning how ultimately that's an incredible path towards being more resilient and really developing, cultivating the sense of mental health.
It's amazing. What a wonderful story. And it's so great that you had that you didn't need the push from someone else. You had that point of self-reflection to actually make a decision and make a change in your life. Do you find that I've seen personally through sort of people I'm aware of have had their own struggles. They really, really, really need to determine on their own that they want to change, as opposed to having friends and loved ones and family. Do you find that that's very common?
Well, let me just add a little piece that was missing from that story. I did have my family come and they kind of did an intervention with me. And they did say like, hey, you know, they didn't say, hey, we're going to give you a couple options here. Take one or the other. They said, hey, we want you to consider this for a moment because you're basically destroying your life right now. Mm-hmm. And so people are actually very important. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the choice has to come from us. I've had plenty of parents who have come into my practice who want their kids to be seen or a spouse come in and say, I'm here because my other spouse wants me to be here, you know, and it doesn't work as well if it's not self-selected. If the choice isn't, I really need to change. I understand why I need to change. That's why in the field of addiction, there's this whole area called motivational interviewing. And the reason is because it's trying to support the person who's really ambivalent, mm-hmm. or resistant towards working with their addiction to understand why. Mm-hmm. And have it come from within and not taught to them, but yeah. Come from within why it's important to help myself, heal myself. And so ultimately the choice has to come from us, but the people we surround ourselves with, make no mistake, have a huge impact, mm-hmm. on bringing that type of idea and reason and energy top of mind to support us. And that's why we've seen so much success in, you know, let's say Alcoholics Anonymous or even in the corporate world. Everyone knows in the corporate world, we could take Jim Rohn's famous saying, he's a famous motivational speaker who said, you're the average of the five people you surround yourselves with.
Yeah.
So that I want to kind of bring that balance, that dialectic, that it has to come from us. And we have to also be aware that the people we're surrounding ourselves with have a major impact on our own health and well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes a lot of sense, I think. And you know, like I said, it's key for the individuals themselves to want to change. That's an yes. important part of it. But having that sort of support network around you makes all the world of difference. I'm interested in terms of the corporate space. You mentioned that you had a really successful career in sales. One of the sort of terms that I hear quite a lot or more frequently is around high functioning anxiety. And sometimes I wonder whether myself and others fit into that category, because we seem to get a lot done and are performing at, you know, higher levels, but then deep down inside, what people don't really realize see is the, you know, the perfectionism and the, maybe the over controlling and nature and some of the work we do. So can you tell me a little bit about high functioning anxiety and sort of what you know about that space to help our listeners?
So anxiety is like a combination of like uncertainty and fear together. And then there's stress underneath it, which stress is the precursor to everything. It's a basic measurement of anything. And there's stress that's good. It gives us energy. So part of this high functioning anxiety, some of the stress there is good. It helps us get things done. It helps us get things and make sure everything's in line and order. And we maybe work harder and longer than other people. And we kind of, in the corporate world, and this has been well known for a while, a lot of people can wear that as a badge on their sleeves. Like, look how incredible I'm able to do. Look how much stress I'm able to tolerate. Yeah. And some people say, wow, you have a high tolerance for stress. And as if that's a positive thing. And so, but then there's a state where the stress starts to become negative for us. Mm-hmm. It seems to help us get things done. At the same time, we have to look at what's our level of feeling good in life in general. If it makes you, there's no one size fits all. If it helps you feel a sense of accomplishment, mm-hmm. and that gives you a boost, mm-hmm. then wonderful. If you notice that it bleeds into your personal life and your and the stress is impacting your relationships or impacting your ability to cool your mind down, just relax and enjoy things in life, then that's a problem. Yeah. And there's a great saying out there, nothing's a problem unless it's a problem. Mm-hmm. So if someone consider themselves to be high functioning anxiety and things are going pretty well in their life, then no problem. But if they notice that their mind's ruminating a lot or catastrophizing a lot or circling those bad neighborhoods, and they find themselves falling into states of just panic or really kind of tense or stressed out, and it's bleeding into their relationships, then that starts to become a problem. We have to look at that. All right, is there a way that I can focus and get things done at work mm-hmm. while also managing my body? Because anxiety is a physical thing.
Yeah.
We think of mental health. When people talk about mental health, they think about their head, like as if they're treating their head, the stuff inside their face, behind their skull and between their ears. But really, like, this nervous system is a brain that winds down the spine, that feeds down through our arms and legs and feet. It's like one thing. Thoughts are everywhere. They're not in our head. Mm-hmm. And so it's an embodied experience, anxiety. So in fact, that's the only real thing, is the physical sensations when it comes to anxiety. All the worries and catastrophes and all these things aren't even facts.
Yeah.
But what is a fact is my heart rate is going really fast and my muscles are really tense. And I come home and my body hurts and I start being irritable with my family or my spouse. Or, I mean, that's all real stuff, objective, and I can measure it. Mm-hmm. And so we want to look at, like, is there a problem anywhere here? And if there is, that's where I want to really address it, whether I'm high functioning or low functioning. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just the high functioning masks it. It's kind of like me, like you were saying. I was sort of a high functioning drug abuser, you know, where I was, no one can tell because I was performing really well.
Yeah, absolutely.
In all areas, I guess. All the partiers thought I was performing well too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure there's plenty of high functioning, you know, professionals out there that just, like you said, they're masking their.
So many.
Yeah,
absolutely. So many.
It's really interesting because, you know, you touched on something that I usually say quite a lot, and that mental health is invisible. And I know that when I was going through my challenges, I'd been diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder, you know, almost 15 years ago, I think. Well, one, I didn't actually know that I had anything wrong, but in my family, out of the 8 of us, 6 children and 2 adults, I'm a middle of the 5 girls. My 7 out of 8 of my family members have anxiety or depression or both. And they've had it persistently pretty much my entire life. I can remember my mum had depression and has depression. And, you know, many family members have different challenges. But when I sort of fell aware of anxiety that I was having, and it was through talking to a counselor initially and then through a psychologist, I was struggling to help people that, like my boyfriend at the time and friends, to understand this invisible thing that I had, because most people assume anxiety is the nerves you get when you do public speaking. And so how would you help someone who doesn't really see the anxiety understand that there's something underlying going on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I like to relate it to something physical and help people understand that, well, with anxiety and high stress, there's also cellular inflammation, and that inflammation impacts the way our brain works and the way that the neurons fire together and the way the electricity works in our body. And that informs our perception and our decision-making. And so really, someone with generalized anxiety, there's something physiological there too. Now, does that mean you can't use your mind to shift that physiology? No, it's all kind of connected, mm-hmm. but there's something actually physiologically going on. So if someone was on the side of the road and they just fell off their bike and they're, you know, their leg, that you can easily see the gash in their leg, the EMT right away, or the that's the, what we have out here, mm-hmm. the EMT right away would pull over, pay attention to the person, look at the wound, see it, very gently inspected and clean it, and be very gentle with it because we can see it. So if we start relating and helping people understand that mental health issues are also physiological, there's no separation. That's the big thing here, mm-hmm. that we are going to evolve into understanding at some point. is that the mind and the body are not two separate things. We're just trying to, we just have a hard time because of our languaging. We're trying to like say, like, we use our mind to change our body. We have to use languaging, even though our languaging is imperfect, to help us communicate about it. But anxiety is physiological, depression is physiological, trauma, something happens to our body when we experience mental trauma. And that's why a lot of the field of psychotherapy right now is moving towards understanding that the intervention isn't just around talking is a way of expressing energy. Yes. So it's helpful to talk about things, and understanding helps us interrupt certain cycles. So understand how we grew up and where the traumas were, or how we grew up with our parents, helps influence our perceptions and beliefs. All of that is really important. Psychodynamic work, all of that. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to anxiety or depression or trauma, what's also really important to understand is the intervention is sometimes in the body. And so we understanding where we're feeling something and experiencing something. The very first thing that I teach, I run a whole global program called, it's a mental health accelerator program.
Yes.
It's called Uncover the Power Within. And the very first thing we teach in there is around how to notice when you're feeling imbalanced, when you're feeling stressed, when the stress, because stress is the underpinning of everything. Mm-hmm. And so when you're feeling that, and then pay attention to your body and see where your body is holding.
Yeah.
Because that's the fight flight response starting to come into action. And if we can get better and better at noticing when that's beginning, because again, that's the underpinnings of anxiety, of depression, of trauma, then we can begin to soften our body or adjust our body in particular ways that also, by the way, shifts the activity in our brain. And then that shifts our perception, because mood influences our perception and decision-making. Mm-hmm. And so that's an absolute foundation for our mental health, is being able to engage and rebalance our bodies out.
Absolutely. I think what you've just described is sort of what I've been experiencing with my psychologist over the years. And it's taken quite a long time. I've had a number of psychologists, and the one that I'm with at the moment has helped me to see what you've just described. And it's been absolutely game-changing for me personally, because as soon as I notice a feeling in my body, whether it's a chest pain or a flutter or whatever it might be, I take a pause and I think, what's just upset me, or what am I stressed about, or what have I got going on? And it really is that sort of first point, as you said, that makes all the difference. So yeah, it's a really good place to start. And I personally have experienced the positives of doing some reflection on that. You mentioned the program. I know you've got over 7,000 people globally in the program online. What has either surprised you, or you know, you've got so many different people from all around the world with different probably personal challenges. Is there anything that's been similar across all of them, other than that they want some help, or anything that's surprised you?
Well, let me differentiate. There's a community, a global community called the Mindful Living Collective, and that's this just open community that provides mindfulness resources and drop-in meditations. And that's just a resource that was opened during the pandemic for the world. And then there's the Uncover the Power Within program, which is more of my personal coaching program that has, you know, a little less than 100 people in it. Yep. And we keep it at that because we need to maintain the integrity of the ability for me to really be present for everyone on a daily basis, mm-hmm. and provide that level of coaching and support on a daily basis with a couple live calls a week and an entire very robust comprehensive curriculum in there. Those are two different things. So people come into the collective, the Mindful Living Collective, just because they're typically interested in getting into a better place. They're interested in those types of resources. They want to have some form of community. And people come into the personal coaching program, which I've since called a mental health accelerator, because they're really wanting to commit to getting into a better place. They're wanting to commit to really feeling a greater sense of personal control in their minds and their lives. They want to be able to focus more on what matters in their life and not have their mind hijacked so much, mm-hmm. as it might have been like all their lives.
Yeah.
So they can ultimately enjoy life more. because as far as we know, and everyone has different spiritual and religious beliefs, but as far as we know, we got this life and you know, hey, there's no time to waste. And so let's start like getting a bit more robust and having that sense of personal control now. And by the way, me being a psychologist and understanding the science, personal control, having a sense of perceived personal control in life is correlated with feeling happier, feeling more well. It's a natural antidepressant. It's a natural anti-anxiety. Feeling a lack of personal control, or that the personal control is outside of ourselves, which is called an external locus of control, is correlated with feeling depressed and anxious, and is really woven strongly in with trauma. And so we can strengthen and embolden that. It just takes a certain type of, what I say is it takes three elements. It takes learning how to feel more, a greater sense of control of our nervous system and our attention. We live in this attention economy right now, but so that we can focus in the ways that we want to focus that serves our minds and our lives. And it takes consistent mentorship around that, because it's easy, especially in this day and age when our attention is brought in so many different places and we have so many strong currents in our life pointing us in different ways, whether it's towards anxiety or depression or certain ways of relating that aren't supportive to us. We need to be able to ask someone on a daily basis, if need be, like, hey, am I on the right track? Here's a question I have. Here's a challenge I'm having. And we need a community of people, a tribe that are like a real tribe, not like a Facebook tribe, not like a, we need people who are committed to encouraging, supporting, providing their own stories that are going to help us keep top of mind what matters, so that that impacts the minutes and hours and days ahead in our lives. And so those three elements, I think, are the magic secret sauce. And that's what that particular program is.
Amazing. I did actually join the Mindful Collective recently, the community. And it's amazing how much positivity there is in that community, and just seeing all the content that's there and the topics that are shared and, you know, everyone sharing their perspectives. It was really nice to see. So I'll make sure I include a link in the show notes for that, for sure.
Beautiful.
I want to touch on, you mentioned attention. I know I have this sort of question a lot of the time, and debate, I guess. There's a lot of discussion around anxiety and depression and rates of suicide and all of these things that are coming up. And I wonder whether the rates are actually increasing, or is it because there is a lot more visibility of it than maybe what we had 10 or 20 years ago? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I would tend to trust the data at right now. And the reason being is because we've had a lot of visibility in the past 10 years. And the whole awareness of mental health has been growing in the past like decade, I would say, with different celebrities and different, you know, now there's a huge awareness around athletes and student athletes, and we've seen the rates going up since then. Yeah. And so I would trust that data. There's more visibility, and that's happening as well. But if you look at the data around anxiety, as an example, over the past decade, you'll see it definitely going up. And so if there's more anxiety, there's probably more depression. And if there's more depression, that means the slippery thing about the mind, or the way our brain works, is both a strength and a weakness. It's because from an evolutionary perspective, the higher our emotional state, the higher our nervous system state is, the more convincing our thoughts are. And it has to be that way, because if we get really scared by something chasing us or a car coming towards it, whatever, we don't have time to deliberate. And so we've evolved in this way. We don't have time to deliberate. And it's the subcortical regions of our brain making very quick decisions about, this is unsafe, let's get out of here, right? Fight, flee, or freeze. And so what happens though, when we get really anxious or depressed and our nervous system's on fire and we say, life's not worth living, well, because the emotional state is so high, we're convinced of it.
Yeah.
In the same way, we're convinced, I need to run, this cheetah is running after me. And even though it's not true and that thought's not a fact, to us, it's a fact in that moment because we're convinced of it because of the emotional state of our nervous system. And to a lesser degree, when we're depressed and we say, hey, I can't seem to help myself, no one can help me, and nothing's going to change, you know, in that moment, we're really convinced of that. or I've tried everything, nothing, or I'm really anxious, this catastrophe is going to happen, everything's going to be an awful mess, you know, or this presentation is going to be terrible. We're kind of convinced of it because the anxiety is high. And so our brain fuses those together. And so we're convinced of it. So it's a very slippery thing. And so that's why when we start seeing rates of anxiety and depression rising, I would trust the data that there's higher suicide rates because people are likely more convinced of those negative fatal thoughts and are more likely to take action around it.
Yeah, it's really interesting area because I find myself very fortunate that I have anxiety, but I haven't experienced depression, even though many members of my family have, and I know a lot of people around me that have as well. So I consider myself fortunate because of sort of the challenges that I know those that have suffered in that space. I know that there are a lot of us that have mental health challenges, and a lot of the time when speaking around this topic, I always usually say to people that, you know, your recovery means different things to different people. I think there's an assumption sometimes that recovery means that you're going to switch off the switch and forget what anxiety is. And I try to say to people, you're not going to forget it. It's like riding a bike. You're always going to know how to ride a bike, even if you never choose to ride one. So what does recovery look like? What are some of the results you've seen in the community, both your program and the community group that you've had with some of the people that have come to you for help?
Sure. So in the beginning of this program, one of the things I also share with people is to get some perspective. So I share this graph. And the graph I call the change journey. And if you can imagine it, you know, right now, it's kind of like when you're first starting something and wanting to make a change in your life, you get kind of excited. Maybe there's an initial motivation, maybe there's some trepidation, but you believe, there's a part of you that believes I can do this. You know, like the very fact that you're trying it, you're going to do it, right? And so you're trying to go to therapy, you're trying to start a program, whatever it might be, is to work with your anxiety or just to feel better in life. Or if you're already feeling better, just to be more resilient and feel a bit happier. And so, but then something happens and we get stuck. It's a little harder than we thought. And so on the graph, we're up and then we're down a little bit. And that's when we start doubting ourselves and we get caught with these thoughts of doubts and this type of thing. If we could be aware of that and notice that as part of the journey, and that's why I show this graph, because I want you to have perspective, there will be times when you feel down and your mind's going to be telling you certain things. It's going to be, you know, looking more, it's going to be doubting you more basically. But then you notice that and you're aware of it, you soften your body, you take a deep breath, release, you re-engage. Reengage, and then you start going up and you start feeling better. Oh, hey, look where I am now. I'm feeling a sense of accomplishment. Look, there's some kind of continuity going on here. And then you get some bills that come in the mail and you realize they're very high bills. Maybe they're doctors, but maybe they, whatever it is. And you start feeling a little bummed out that your finances aren't exactly where you want them to be, you know, things like this, right? And then you get hooked by that and you say, oh, things aren't so well after all. And then you realize like, wow, I've really made some progress. You remember the things that you've been learning, and you use that and you go back up again. But now see, the next down that you experience will be higher than the initial up even, because the graph is going up and down, but it's trending up even with the up and down. And so that's the change journey. So with anxiety, as an example, or depression or other kinds of trauma, those are all in my mind traumas.
Yeah.
They're trauma. They're basically, a trauma is something the brain says like, that was pretty aversive. I don't want to experience that again. Let's try and stay away from that. So it's on the lookout for those things. So meanwhile, we're healing, we're getting tools, we're feeling stronger and all this stuff. And then something happens, a cue, a trigger, something comes out of context. Maybe we have a dream and it has some kind of contextual cue to it. And we get hooked by it the next morning. We have a panic attack in the middle of the night. We can feel anxious the next day. We can feel a little depressed, you know, after that, whatever it might be. But what we have to remember is these traumas of anxiety, depression, or some other kind of trauma sets up a little bit of a monitor in the back of our minds to be on the lookout for these cues. So we can get hooked even in our journey on life. So you can be, it's the same thing as addiction in some ways. You know, it's the same thing as addictive behaviors. You can get caught off guard and hooked, but that doesn't mean you're back to square one. Doesn't mean you haven't learned and grown and you don't have these resources to begin with, but you could have what's called flare-ups in life. And flare-ups in the world of addiction is urges and cravings all of a sudden. flare up in the field of depression is you can have some bad days or you can have some bad weeks. Mm-hmm. And anxiety, it might be, you might have a panic attack, but you've been free from it for years, but all of a sudden you have it again. Or a generalized anxiety, you can all of a sudden that comes back in a certain way, you know, with a certain level of intensity. Mm-hmm. And so that's just a flare up. And that could be, honestly, that could be there. You know, this could be something we live with for our lives. It's part of being human.
Yeah.
It's not a non-human experience. Yeah. The reason there's a field of mental health is because billions of people experience these things. It's just part of being human. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yes.
It's nothing wrong with you for having it. Yeah. It's just like, it's just something we don't talk about very much because we don't like to be feel, it's perceived as weak. So yeah. We don't want to feel weak because from an evolutionary perspective, the weak animal was attacked and sent out of the tribe. So we don't want that. So we have that perception. So we don't talk about it, but everyone has some form of it to some degree or another on some continuum. And so it is. So we have to learn how to relate to it skillfully and release the shame from it. And
yeah.
And we do that by having these conversations right now. And we do that by celebrities and star athletes and whoever who people look up to talking about it more. And mm-hmm. So there's more of an acceptance around it. You know, that's, I think the younger generations have a little bit of a better handle on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like it's becoming a little bit more popular now to be someone, you know, either like sort of celebrity stars, but even some of the executives that when we do speaking with Beyond Blue, one of our largest national not-for-profits, when an executive stands up and says, look, I've got, you know, OCD, or I've got mental health issues like this, or maybe they don't even have to explain what it is. They just have to acknowledge that they do. I think it opens the door for staff and others to say things. So in my time growing up 15 years ago in corporate and knowing that I had what I had, I remember sitting in meetings, you know, doodling in the back of notebooks, trying to my best to stay calm because I knew that I had an hour drive home, which made me extremely anxious. So now I publicly say, I have, you know, an anxiety disorder, but I'll still get the work done and I'll get results. And I think that's opened up the door for conversations with others in the team as well. I've had a lot of people in my team as well. So I think more executives could help that conversation.
I even wonder about that term,
yeah.
Anxiety disorder, because it means something's out of order. Yeah. And I wonder if that's actually true. So many people experience that maybe it's just part of a different order.
Yeah.
And you don't, you know, you, it feels out of balance a little bit. So you're working with it to be a little bit more at ease and calm and feel a greater sense of personal control within your life. But to call it a disorder, I know that that's the term we use in the field of mental health.
Yeah.
And, but I'm wondering about it as you say it out loud, if that even needs to be shared in that way,
yeah.
Which is otherwise I struggle a bit with anxiety, or I get anxious, you know, I have this kind of underlying anxiety, you know, and that helps me and it hinders me, and you know, but here I am, I'm letting you know about it.
Yeah, absolutely. It is one of those ones that my husband always says, you always say, hi, I'm Fatima and I have anxiety. And I'm like, no, I don't do that. He's like constantly question me because he thankfully doesn't have anything. And it's interesting that some people are just so optimistic and positive, and it seems like they don't have a care or even a moment of anxiety, but I'm sure underlyingly they probably do, but maybe they control and manage it better perhaps. I'm not sure if you've got any thoughts on that.
Everyone's on a different continuum, and you know, hey, some people are more talented in certain things than others, and some people have to work a little bit harder to gain, you know, the skills and strength. That's like anything, like a musician or a athlete or a someone in the field of someone who's great with their emotions, someone who has to, you know, struggle a little bit more with it, and you know, it's all. There is a reality around building skills and people, some people who are naturally more talented mm-hmm. at something than other. And so some people are more naturally resilient. It's in their genes.
Yeah.
It's okay. So then there's that too. And then there's this other thing too. And so we're all in this.
Just dropped out, but I'll correct that.
Yep.
So one of the things that I know you are going to tell me about is the 7 mental health superpowers. What is it and why do they matter?
So this is all the layout for the Uncover the Power Within program. These are things that have come from my last 2 decades of experience as a psychologist and as someone who's a trained mindfulness teacher and and from my own personal experience. And so the very having a sense of a realistic perspective on the very first thing we have to understand is having a very realistic perspective on how change happens in life, because everything is based on expectations. And the whether we continue on with something and commit to be able to grow a strength in life or to get better at something is all based on commitment and showing up in some form of consistency. If you want to learn how to play guitar, you got to play it regularly, or piano. You know, you want to learn how to get stronger, you got to exercise regularly. You know, you exercise once a month so much. That's why I always said with yoga, it's better to do yoga 20 minutes a day than it is like once a week for an hour and a half. So, you know, with any of this, we need to be more consistent. And so understanding the change obstacles can become our greatest teachers, allow us to not get so hooked by the down moments mm-hmm. that happen. So that's the very first superpower, is having perspective mm-hmm. around how change really happens, how it's not just like I'm learning and I'm right up. It's going to be up and down. And during the down moments, those are some of my greatest opportunities. So that's the very first one, because it supports us with not giving up when we're wanting to make these changes. The second one is learning how to relax our nervous system, mm-hmm. because our nervous system's at the foundation of our perception and decision-making. And so if we can learn how to be more balanced within our nervous system and a bit more at ease, we can be more in control of our focus and our attention. And also, it's just more enjoyable to be more relaxed. There might be some kind of addiction to stimulation and some level of anxiousness too. Mm-hmm. There's something that the most powerful person in the room mm-hmm. is the one that walks in and seems most at ease and calm in their body.
Yeah. And there's plenty of those around.
Yeah. It's typically not. So there's that. Right. So we can train that within ourselves. So that's the first thing. The second one is learning how to bring energy into our experience. Mm-hmm. So we can like get kind of drowsy or bored or sleepy at times. And if we do that, it's really hard to stay committed to things, whether it's staying committed in our relationship, like being able to like foster a sense of connection in our relationship, mm-hmm. or whether it's to our kids, or whether it's at work and being able to focus and be productive at something I really want to accomplish, or listening in a meeting or whatever it might be, right? Our ability to bring energy into our experience it has everything to do with our motivation and our follow through. So the second one is to be able to learn how to become more awake. And we can do these in different ways. Lots of people have different experiences on what helps them with their wakefulness aside from caffeine. Not that caffeine is a bad thing, but it's we can do things in our daily life, certain ways of breathing, certainly certain ways of pairing our breath in certain ways. We can literally like bring more oxygen, more energy into our bodies, mm-hmm. And certain things we do physically. And so that's the second one, learning how to bring more energy. So here you have the balance of the first two, mm-hmm. The second and third superpower here, which is being relaxed and awake.
Yeah.
Imagine what could be different if you walked around the world being relaxed and awake.
Yeah.
And the third one is like, you can think of these first three as like a three-legged stool.
Mm-hmm.
The third one is about learning how to concentrate and be focused. So there's certain things we can do to support our own level of concentration and focus. Now, right now, what's happening typically in our lives is our focus is being stolen from us in all kinds of ways. Yeah. You know, as we all know, companies have spent billions of dollars, you know, trying to pull us into different directions. I saw a recent meme with Mark Zuckerberg on it that said, "I don't pay for your attention. Attention pays me." and so there it is, right? That was just like an example, not anything against him or anything, but that's just how everything works right now. And so for our ability to control our attention, it means everything. And in the field of business, there's been a term that's been floated around for decades called time management, which everyone here knows.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've learned is it's not so much about time management, but it's much more about attention management.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can have all the time blocks you want, but if you can't pay attention in them, none of it really matters. And so the first, the second, third, and fourth superpower is about being relaxed, awake, and focused. Mm-hmm. And so when we have those three pillars, we're basically unstoppable. Yeah. Like, we can learn anything. We're going to integrate material more. We're going to be able to be more involved, more intentionally paying attention, follow through on our intentions. We're going to live with a greater sense of integrity in our lives, which ultimately, when we look back towards our last breaths, looking back onto our lives, we're going to say, like, I was there and I did it exactly how I wanted it to, as imperfectly as it might have come out at times, mm-hmm. you know, but I feel good about it. Right. So we have this kind of relaxed, awake, focused, and aware is the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I'm combining these. The first one is having that perspective. The second one is kind of relaxed and awake. The third one is more focused and aware. So we have this more focused and aware. So that's where we start bringing in this mindfulness, this sense of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's where it all begins with anxiety or depression or addictive behaviors. If we can learn how to become more aware of the reactivity that's happening within us, certain types of thoughts we're having, certain types of sensations our body is tied to with any of this, mm-hmm. The emotional experience, once we're able to name it, we're able to tame it. And so we can kind of play with this. So we have the relaxed and awake, we have the focused and aware. And the third one, I mean, the next one, sorry, I know I'm jumping around the numbers, but those are the first three. Those are our first three. Yeah. So the first one, I'll just kind of give a summary. First one is having perspective.
Yes.
The second, that's the change journey. The second one is being relaxed and awake.
Mm-hmm.
The third one is being focused and aware.
Mm-hmm.
So we're training these capacities. The next one is we realize, like, hey, life's not that easy all the time. And along the journey, I run across obstacles.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're really hard and the self-critical mind starts to hook me and I start doubting myself and I start beating myself up. And so we start to ignite this experience of self-compassion. So self-compassion has gained, for those of you who don't know, on the other end of this, has a ton of science that's grown around it in the past 10, 15 years, mm-hmm. around the idea that it's the idea that there's some kind of internal suffering or struggle that's happening with the inclination to want to support yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It has everything to do with emotional intelligence and growing our emotional intelligence, how to better understand what we're needing in particular moments so that we don't just start, our mind just doesn't start running away from us, but instead we can move in the direction that's most skillful so we can rebalance and again, go back to focusing on what matters.
Mm-hmm.
It has everything to do with courage,
mm-hmm.
and vulnerability.
Yeah.
If I was a doctor, I can't heal you unless you allow yourself to be vulnerable in front of me. If you come in with all your plates of armor on, I can't see what's going on with you. And so we have to take all that off to be vulnerable and have to see it. So we allow ourselves to train ourselves in this incredibly courageous strength,
mm-hmm.
to heal ourselves. So then after that, the next one is around learning how to enjoy life more, training our brain to be more aware of what's good, all the wonderful things around us, all the areas of positive psychology that we understand now that illuminate, refresh, and create greater resiliency in our lives and trend us towards greater well-being. So we start to ignite and train these strengths around appreciation and around joy and around more around gratitude and more around being glad in life, seeing awe in our daily life. And this is something that's happening all around us, but we don't pay attention to. Yeah. Our brain doesn't stick to it. And so we have to train the brain to do that. And with practice and repetition, you will see it more,
mm-hmm.
and ultimately enjoy things more and be more resilient. Because when we're feeling better, adversive stuff that happens in our life doesn't stick to us as much.
Yeah.
And so there's a way to train that. The sixth one is around developing a sense of compassion, meaning, and connection. And so we know, and purpose. And so it's more outward. It's more around relationships. And so we know that connections at the epicenter of well-being. We see that in nature.
Yeah.
When you see if you're walking on a high wire and there's a strong net beneath you, you'll be less fearful. You know, when you see a spider and there's a very strong web, that spider is going to catch more of the insects there. So there's something around those connections and that strength that's important. So we start training a bit more in that. And the final one is training more in equanimity and balance. That's the idea, the understanding that things in life shift and change. And when we understand that, we tend to not get hooked as much, walk in life with a bit more balance, a bit more inner peace. That's there because we're more grounded, and we have a much deeper level of acceptance with the shifting nature of life itself. Mm-hmm. And so those are the seven superpowers. Yeah. And the reason I broke them up initially was because each one has a couple different elements to it. So the idea of like the relaxing in the beginning, mm-hmm. there's a relaxing, and then there's another part of being awake in that. And so I kind of separated them, but those are the seven. Hopefully we captured those.
Are they, that's really helpful. And I'm wondering, in addition to being in your program, you've written more than half a dozen books. So can I assume that one of the books covers some of these if people want to read more, or somewhere on the website or through subscribing to the program?
Yeah. So the best, most complimentary book into what we just talked about right now is the one on Uncovering Happiness.
Beautiful.
That one is about creating resiliency in life. The tagline for that is overcoming depression with mindfulness and self-compassion. But ultimately, it's about building these resilient strengths in life. And so you don't have to have depression to experience that book, but that book will go over most of these elements that we talked about here.
Beautiful. I'll make a note of that in the show notes as well. You've written so many books. I don't know how you get time with everything else that you've been doing. Do you have a favorite book? Is that your favorite or one of the others?
Of the ones that I've written?
Yeah.
You know, they're all different and for different reasons. Like, for example, my initial book was that I co-authored was the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Workbook. So if someone's looking for like a program to follow in a book, that would be a really great one to do. If someone's looking for one to work more with depression, anxiety, mm-hmm. and being resilient in that, I think Uncovering Happiness is the one for that. Mm-hmm. If somebody's looking for a book with shorter chapters that's going to help them instill more mindfulness and positive emotions in their life and have more of that, mm-hmm. then The Now Effect would be a great book for that. And so, you know, those different reasons, there's some other books. But that's, if someone has an issue with travel anxiety, I also wrote one called Mindfulness Meditations for the Anxious Traveler. But there's, you know, and there's some card decks too, if those are more what people want, you know.
Amazing. So, yeah. I wish I knew about your travel book before I started traveling, because I remember starting a job on a Monday, being told by my boss, then boss, that Wednesday I was flying interstate, which is only a 2-hour flight, but the paranoia and the catastrophizing that I was having, you would probably wouldn't be surprised, to be honest, but yeah, I wish I knew about it. So I'll make sure I include all of that.
Yeah. And you're not alone in that for a second. That's a, you know, that's a big fear a lot of people have. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess you don't even have to have anxiety to have that fear. People just fear travel, you know, first time anyway. So I had to remind myself a little bit of that. I just want to touch on a couple of things. One that you mentioned in the seven superpowers around relaxation. And one of the things I've been talking about and hearing a lot about is grounding techniques. Can you just tell us a little bit about the benefits of grounding and how they're useful? Because we speak about its importance to help, you know, bring yourself to a relaxed state.
Yeah. So if we come back to the initial idea that our part of anxiety is that we're like really in our, we're really caught in our thoughts and we're believing them, even though if we step outside of them, we look at them, we ask ourselves, is this even true? I know these to be factual. We'd say, well, they're not really facts, these thoughts. So what we need to do is come back into what we know, what's real, like what's actually a fact, like bring yourself to the facts of the moment. That will ground you. And so the facts is, oh, you know, here's my body. I'm noticing there's tension in my shoulder. And so I'm going to soften or roll my shoulders. I'm coming back into my body. I feel my feet on the floor. Yep, I can sense the feet on the floor right now. I can feel my body on the chair. I feel I just took a breath. I mean, these are all real things. And when you start noting what's actually happening in the moment, that in itself becomes grounding. And the reason is for a lot of people, and the reason is because we have two different levers in our brain. We have the lever that can be present to what's here, eating a delicious piece of food and really tasting that, really listening to a friend or someone and really hearing what they're saying. This lever that allows us to be present to what's actually happening. Then we have a lever that kicks us into what's called the narrative network of our brain, or the default network of our brain. And that's the one that's trying to figure out, problem solve, figure out how to get away from uncomfortable situations, because it's trying to help us figure everything out so we can, you know, survive. And so, but meanwhile, it's kicking up all these potential scenarios and catastrophes and things like that. And because the emotion is heightened, we tend to believe them. And so we get caught in this loop. Mm-hmm. I have a free talk on my website, a free training, all about how to relieve anxiety naturally.
Yep.
And then that leads into an option to move into a 21-day program on relieving anxiety naturally. But just the free thing itself is like 45 minutes long, and it explains a lot of this stuff. And so, but that would be, so coming into our bodies is grounding. Listening to somebody who's talking to us and really listening to them is grounding. I love this 3x3 practice. If we're really out of it, this 3x3 practice is really helpful. It's actually been helpful even with schizophrenia. Is paying attention to three things that you're seeing and naming them, like leaves on a tree, an orange wall over there. 3x3, and then three things that you're hearing, and then three things that you're feeling, because that's another way of bringing you here, but it's a little bit more cognitive.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a bridge of, well, I can't really get my body. My body's too overwhelmed right now. And so I can't even feel my feet on the floor. If we're disassociating, let's say, if it's like to that three by three practice is brilliant in that way. It's also brilliant if we're on vacation somewhere and we catch ourselves like, you know, we're not even enjoying the vacation because our mind's so worried about work or worried about this and that. And we say, hold on a second, I'm in the ocean right now, 3x3. I'm seeing this ocean. I'm seeing the ripples of the water. I'm seeing the clouds in the sky, seeing these kids laughing over there, hearing these kids laugh. And you're all of a sudden you're like brought back and you're like, oh, I can't believe I'm out here. This is amazing. Yeah. You know, like, so it can really bring you to the moment. So that's another really wonderful grounding one. And what happens is when you're focusing on the present moment, your body, this 3x3, it dials down the lever of the default mode of the narrative network.
Amazing.
So we're not trying to quiet the mind.
Yeah.
We're not trying to do any of that. We're just shifting our focus to something else, because wherever our focus goes, we invite an energy to flow. And so we're shifting our focus to something else, these different grounding exercises, which will eventually pull the lever down on that part of the brain, which, by the way, also works with insomnia and things like that too. Amazing.
It's fascinating to sort of understand the sort of the mechanics behind it. I mean, I've heard of some of the concepts around, you know, the seeing and listening and things like that, but actually to understand why it works, because often you hear, I mean, I've been told to do mindfulness for a really long time. I've only started getting into it in recent years. But when I think about sort of the mechanics behind why it works through reading books like yours, it really does help to put it into perspective, because I'm sort of someone that likes to look at facts. So now understanding the science behind it actually makes it a lot more welcomed for me personally, and I'm sure for others as well.
Totally. Yeah. Science is a great bridge to allowing us to be open to all this stuff. Yeah,
it's absolutely fascinating. We're almost out of time. I have I just have one more question for you. I know that I came across you initially through the Calm app. How did that collaboration come about?
It was interesting because Alex too, who started Calm years ago, I was doing a symposium called the Uncovering Happiness Symposium, and I was leading it, and I interviewed him as someone who was just beginning the Calm app. This was when it was just beginning.
Yeah.
And, you know, in this field, and he was kind of like new in it, you know, really in the field of like meditation and mindfulness. His big success prior to that was like building this $1 million homepage, which people bought pixels for, and he made, you know, millions of dollars people buying pixels on his homepage. And so, then, you know, they've been aware of me and all my work that I've done across a variety of apps that are out there. And Tamara, who is the mindfulness director there, knew of me. And so she reached out to me and asked me, like, would I be willing to lead some meditations on Calm? And I think at that point, no one but her had done any because she was their sole person there. And so that's how it happened. So we went to the studio and recorded a few meditations in there. And that's how that began. Yeah.
Amazing. I follow the app and regularly listen. I've listened to yours as well and find them really useful. And also the sleep stories, I've changed my life. I listen to it almost every night as well. So yeah, it's definitely been great. We are out of time, Elijah. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners, a call to action, a piece of advice or a question to ponder or anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up?
I would just say, if you're somebody who wants to really support making a change in your life or shoring up your own sense of integrity or mental health or wanting to feel a greater sense of personal control over your mind and your life, then you want to really consider those three elements. There are things to learn. There are real science-backed things that can support you in feeling more relaxed and focused and attendant to get your brain to attend to more balanced ways of enjoying life more. And then even with that, if that was enough, then we wouldn't need as many books or evergreen courses that are out there. We'd be fine. We wouldn't need 5 million diet books a year or whatever it is, right? There's plenty that will work fine.
Yeah.
But by themselves, they aren't really enough. You really want to make a change. You need it. It's really helpful to have a mentor that you trust, that you can have access to and ask questions to along the way and get motivation from and get support from. If you really want to make a change, if you really want to be consistent with it, I would highly suggest investing in that person.
Yeah.
Find a person you trust, invest in that person. And then I would really want you to take to heart to do a little bit of an audit on your relationships in your life. And say, if this is the change I want to make, mental health, I want to start taking care of myself, loving myself more. I want to start moving in the direction of my own health and well-being. Then you want people around you who are like, yes, I want this for you too. And I want this for me too. And so the very thought of this person elevates that top of mind for you, which makes it more accessible to your short-term memory, which makes you much more likely to do it. Yeah. And so you want that epic curriculum, you want that mentor you trust, and you want that community. I think if you have those three things, you're going to accelerate the shifts you want to make in your life.
Amazing. I really appreciate all of that. I will put all of the links in the show notes for sure, and definitely be taking you up on that program offer. It's been such a great, almost an hour. I think we could have probably spoken for several more hours, but I know you're a busy person, so you've probably got a lot to go and get into. But thank you so much, Elijah, for your time. I'm sure that everybody listening and watching would really appreciate all the insights that you shared in this hour with me. So thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for putting this on.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Please share this with someone or rate it if you enjoyed it. Don't forget to follow us on social media, and to stay up to date with all things Agile Ideas, go to our website www.agilemanagementoffice.com. I hope you've been able to learn, feel, or be inspired today. Until next time, what's your Agile Idea?